At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Elliot Bazzano. For every program, we choose a new and exciting book and chat with the author. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Ramon Harvey, Aziz Foundation Lecturer in Islamic Studies at Ibrahim College in London, and author of The Quran and the Just Society, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2018. The Quran and the Just Society by Dr. Ramon Harvey tackles a topic as big and meaningful as the title of the book suggests. What is justice? What words does the Quran use to explore the meaning of justice? How did the social context of the Quran exist in its time as compared with later time periods? To what extent does the Quran give specific guidance for realizing justice? And to what extent does it give more general principles? Dr. Harvey treats these questions and others as he guides the reader through his erudite, yet accessible and clearly organized monograph. He draws smoothly from numerous modern and pre-modern thinkers and engages closely with the Quranic text throughout the book. The extensive glossary also aids the reader in making sense of the material. Given the broad relevance of justice in the Quran to any number of fields, the book should interest not only Islamicists and Quranic studies scholars, but also political scientists, scholars of exegesis more broadly, and even a general audience. I hope you enjoy the interview, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Ramon Harvey. Hello, Dr. Harvey. Thank you so much for joining us today for New Books in Islamic Studies.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you about your book, The Quran and the Just Society. And our tradition here on New Books in Islamic Studies is to ask authors a little bit about their intellectual autobiography before we talk about the book. So could you tell us a little bit about how you became interested in Islamic studies and then Quranic studies in particular?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think one of the most important things was conversion to Islam, actually. I was previously interested in philosophy, and I didn't find the answers I guess I was personally seeking in sort of pure philosophy, which, you know, I studied at degree level. And I found the answers that I wanted in Islam. But then that sent me to sort of continue studies in Islamic studies after that. And I developed quite broad interests and became particularly fascinated in the Quran and also other sort of disciplines and subjects. And interestingly, I eventually sort of have come full circle back to kind of philosophy as well. But sort of now filtered through kind of my confessional approach and my sort of Islamic studies as well.
Mm-hmm. And what about in terms like undergrad or graduate school? What were some influential books that have informed your scholarship in particular ways?
Yeah. As I guess we might come on to more, I was particularly influenced by in the Arabic tradition. Al-Maturidi's Kitab al-Tawhid, which is a kind of important theological text, an early theological text. And I, you know, it's a very, very difficult book to read and understand. And so I found it as this great enigma to be sort of unraveled. And I would sort of try to read it a bit in graduate school and couldn't really get far, but was interested a little in the PhD, a bit more has come up, and then it's kind of an ongoing interest. Also in tafsir kind of studies, Mazrudi's got a very interesting book as well, but also Razi and his tafsir al-Kabir. This was influential in my sort of PhD and sort of in the scholarship that went into the book in the early stages. And I think the reason for that was that Razi is such an interesting thinker in terms of his ethical appreciation, his theology, drawing also from the whole exegetical tradition. So I found him just a really thoughtful thinker. And then in the academic sort of sphere, you know, some of the sort of classic works that I found very useful were people like actually Watt, William Montgomery Watt, his Muhammad at Mecca and Muhammad at Medina books. I think they're absolute classics in kind of Sira studies in the academy, and so much kind of social thinking there. And there was I think that, you know, there was a period when obviously they were very, very influential, and then maybe he seems like that's in the 50s, it's a long time ago, but I think they still stand up as major works that should be consulted and used. He just kind of summarized so much of the kind of sources and also interpreted them. And then Fazl Rahman, of course, very important for his kind of ethical thinking, various works of his. Muhammad Draz, particularly in the translation of the moral, called the Moral World of the Quran, which was originally a French, he wrote this as a French PhD at the Sorbonne, and then he it's been translated into Arabic and into English. And so I read the English translation was what I read, and I found that very interesting. And then finally, Izutsu, with his classic ethical religious concepts in the Quran, and just his whole way of sort of semantic analysis. It's just a major sort of influence on some of my methods. So those gives you some sort of impression of some of the major people.
Yeah, and it's cool to hear you articulate these names. And I think one of the many positive highlights of your book is that you get the sense that you're thinking about this from a lot of different angles. And so it makes a lot of sense to hear that you have these diverse influences in like really meaningful ways from different time periods. And so I think it's also cool you describe Maturidi as an enigma. So you're informed by an enigma, which I think is cool because it means like we're still being challenged, right? Even when we're producing books and stuff like that. So what about influential mentors? Are there people that you've worked with that have had a particular impact on your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to name two major figures that have been really important to my sort of development. So I think the first person is Professor Abdul Halim of SOAS. He was my supervisor for the PhD. I also studied with him at the master's level on his Quranic studies course. And the thing about, and also I've pretty much read everything he's sort of written and so on, and you know, extensively engaged with his translation, which I think actually is a major work in he doesn't tell you all the moves that are going on behind the scenes, but if you read it carefully, you get a sense of his kind of tafsir as well, that's sort of implicit there. And so, I mean, just, you know, I would say just his kind of approach to this idea of the theme of the chronic theme, how to kind of go into a theme and explore it and, you know, do that in a way that's very sensitive to the tradition, but also engaged in the kind of modern academy. And then, of course, you know, he's got the Journal of Quranic Studies that he established, which I've, you know, I've published in, the conference that he runs every 2 years. So just in many ways, he's been a kind of someone who's been a mentor for me, who, you know, has been instrumental in kind of getting me off the ground in my scholarship and all these things. So I've got a big debt to his work and to his sort of help and support. You know, he wrote the foreword to the book, and it goes on. So that's one person. The second figure is someone who is also, he is a doctor and was an Oxford academic for a long time, but he's also a traditional sheikh. And this is Dr. Akram Nadwi. And he is a very interesting scholar, particularly in hadith studies. So, you know, I studied with him a number of different disciplines and also particularly kind of Bukhari and Tirmidhi, which is, you know, two major books of hadith. And he's informed me into kind of the hadith methods, the kind of the classical Muslim scholarship on history and many other things. And so I benefited a lot from his instruction and his sort of discussion. And as well as his sort of great knowledge in sort of multilingual knowledge, he's also got a very kind of open and critical mindset to sort of thinking about about issues in the tradition, and I've taken a lot from his kind of whole approach to things as well. So I think those two figures are kind of in different ways have been very influential.
Well, cool. So something you said leads to the next thing I wanted to ask you about. And so you mentioned that Dr. Nedwi has his foot in these sort of two rooms of academia and traditional scholarship, right? However we want to define those lines. And you get this issue in the beginning of your book, and you address this question on, like, is scholarship on the Quran objective? And you don't ask it in just that way. But I wonder, how would you respond to that question? Is scholarship on the Quran objective?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding or my approach, I guess, that has developed through writing the book and through my ongoing studies is that absolute objectivity is something of a myth. And it's, you know, it's something that obviously will be around, you know, from different points of view, from a kind of traditional scholarship point of view. There may be some idea like that also from a kind of contemporary academic view. I think an issue that I you know, that can be problematic is that in some of sort of older academic Quranic studies, there's this idea sometimes that sort of a Western non-Muslim approach may be more objective, and I think that you know is problematic. I think now many scholars are becoming more thoughtful, and they are understanding that everyone has some kind of contingent background, you know, and that everyone has certain assumptions, and that really what's interesting is to, and in my point of view, most fruitful, is that we lay our cards on the table and we say, these are my assumptions, these are my sort of, this is my methodology, this is my theory, and then where do you go from there? And you can agree or disagree. So it's more about being honest about our subjectivity, I guess, and not to say there cannot be truth, but just that, you know, I think that, you know, that we none of us are who are studying these texts have an absolute window to you know, the divine mind or to the absolute truth of them, and we have to just do our best effort with the tools we have at our disposal. And so I try to put this forward even in my teaching. I try to sort of I teach advanced Quranic studies at Ibrahim College, and also I teach at Cambridge Muslim College in Quran and Hadith studies. And what I try to do with students is, and they're mainly, you know, or exclusively Muslim kind of seminary students, is I try to sort of teach them or let them realize that, you know, there's these both sets of premises and assumptions that need to be unpacked. The assumptions of the tradition and of the, you know, exegetical tradition and so on, and also the assumptions you're going to find in academic scholarship of various persuasions, and just trying to clarify them and give them the tools to kind of negotiate around. And that's where you can get interesting arguments and interesting scholarship of all types. So, you know, I think that's important. I think there is a big difference between consistently working from your premises and sort of contradicting them due to some kind of expediency. So I think we all can recognize something, a scholar who's inconsistent, a scholar who, you know, doesn't stick to their own agenda or their own approach, or, you know, makes errors or these things, I think, or have problematic assumptions that don't stand up for whatever reason. But I think that's a big difference between that and, you know, trying to say there's some absolute objectivity that we can reach in any particular way.
Mm-hmm. And that's related to, I think, a general theme of the book, which you make explicit at certain times, is that the Quran has, you know, a lot of different ideas about justice, for example, since that's the topic, and that it invites the reader to think about these terms in particular ways. And so I think it's really interesting how you look at the Quranic rhetoric and not just what it's saying, but how it's trying to persuade the reader. So if we could use that as a jumping off point to talk about the main themes of the book, how does the Quran define justice? Let's start off with that big question. What is justice in the Quran?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that on the one hand, the Quran, and as you're saying, you know, has this rhetorical register, and it challenges its readers and it speaks to its readers. So the Quran, I think, doesn't fully define justice. It's more that it calls its audience to be just and expects at least the initial audience, you know, you know, of its time of revelation, you could say, to sort of just understand kind of what that is. And then at the same time, the Quran will supplement that with various rules or commandments or you know, or explanations. But I do think also the Quran calls the readers to think deeply and to reflect and to, you know, and to try to puzzle things out as well. And so that's why I think it's so fruitful to kind of still be trying to think about this idea of justice in the Quran, even so many centuries later. In terms of how I would define it, I guess, I mean, I quite early on, I think in the introduction, I sort of say there's three main ways three levels that one could approach the idea of studying justice in the Quran. One is kind of virtue ethics approach to look at how can the individual be just, right? And the second would be a sort of theological ethics to say, well, you know, what does it mean for God to be just in the Quran? And what's the relationship between God and human beings in those terms? And the third is the social ethics. How can humans be just to each other? And what I basically say early on is they're all valid. They all come into my story a bit, but the main one I'm focusing on is the social ethics level. So I kind of scope it in that way. So I think there could be a completely different book that looks at some of these other levels much more closely, but that's not what I did. And that's why obviously the title is what it is. And I think within that, you know, I came up with this definition for social justice in the Quran, and this definition, you know, it kept on being refined, and it was longer, and I managed to kind of pin it down as much as I was able by the time the book was published. And so, what I actually say is that social justice, and this is for me, this, and maybe we can come on to that, is the condition or the ideal condition of the wisdom of God's writ that meets the scale of moral value. And so obviously that needs unpacking. So what I'm basically saying is justice is a condition of society that is aimed for by the underlying principles of the divine law, and that these principles of the divine law, of the divine objectives, or Sharia even, are in agreement with a natural state or natural law that is also kind of that's been created in the world. So I'm kind of... And I think that's an important idea for the book, and something that developed was trying to, in a way, read the Quran through a sort of natural law theory, while acknowledging that because it's the Quran, it's obviously not just about natural law. It's also this divine law that's being revealed. So I think all of this can come together. And I guess that's some of the sort of definition or theory that then I try to sort of deliver the details of that and explain that through kind of these sub themes of different sort of aspects of social justice in the Quran.
Yeah. And I want to ask you more about this idea of natural law and how that relates, but could you first distinguish just explicitly between qist and adl in terms of how those are like keywords in the Quran that you talk quite a bit about in the book?
Yeah, sure. When I first, I remember something interesting when I first sort of started to look into this whole theme of justice in the Quran right at the beginning of my PhD, I was coming up with all sorts of sort of funny directions and you know, interesting side routes. And I remember Professor Abdul Halim saying to me, one thing you just need to do is you need to look up all the words the Quran uses for justice. And it's just a really obvious point. But it wasn't what the way I was kind of thinking of first approaching it. And I didn't do this for about 6 months, and I did all sorts of other things. And then I came back to realize that was exactly what I should have been doing. Something I discovered is that many tafsirs basically treat this word qist as a synonym for adl. So what that means is sort of as generic words for justice. So adl is the more famous kind of word for justice, and qist is this other word that also can have that meaning. And so many tafsirs will say adl huwa al-qist, you know, adl, you know, or qist huwa al-adl. Or, and they'll normally do it that way around. They'll normally say that qist basically reduces to adl. And I kind of felt, well, if the Quran is using this other term, surely there's a meaning to that. And so although it is true that they can sort of both generically mean a sort of general justice, I kind of came to the conclusion through sort of reading the different passages is that adl tends to be the equitableness of an individual. Right. And also the sort of verbal forms that are associated with this. And then the qist and the verbal forms associated with that tends to be more an objective standard of a sort of societal justice. So when I'm talking about, you know, the just society, I'm actually in my mind thinking this is qist, even though if someone were to sort of translate the title of my book into Arabic, they probably wouldn't reach for qist as a word because adl is the more famous justice word. So, but I found that this is quite an important distinction. And although I think it is implicitly in various places, people may have made these points, kind of as a major sort of, I guess, kind of linguistic or kind of terminological move, I hadn't seen it in the literature I was familiar with. So I felt it was something that the book builds on and develops in an interesting way and hopefully will be a fresh thing for people who are reading. And it's not just something, sorry, I was just going to add one little point. It's not just something that is at the beginning of the book. And I say this, it's something that kind of, as the book proceeds, it's a point that gets returned back to that. Oh, and here we see why there's this distinction of language in this passage or that passage. So I try to sort of embed it in the later kind of parts as well.
Mm-hmm. So if we come back to this idea of natural law and how social justice relates to society, but also, of course, the individual, and then there's the question of, well, how does the individual know what the law is? Yeah. And so some other keywords you explore is fitra and nabua. Yeah. And so could you say a little bit about what those two terms have to do with justice and how it relates to this idea of the individual knowing how to behave?
Yes. Yeah. I think the concept of fitra is kind of means the natural state of human beings. I think this is a really important concept for the Quran and particularly for ethical sort of discussion of the Quran. Within my book, I argue that the Quran definitely treats human beings as capable of kind of moral knowledge before the revelation comes. So the Quran obviously emphasizes the revelation because it is, you know, it is a revelation. It conceives itself in those terms, but it's still in my reading, at least, sort of demonstrates that there is this kind of knowledge of right and wrong, at least at some level, before the revealed book comes to human beings. And I don't treat this as a kind of supernatural sense that is kind of this sort of super sense, but rather that human beings are kind of able to, in their kind of through sort of ethical reasoning, through their sort of ordinary sensory experience, have an awareness of right and wrong, which correlates to something that, you know, is in some sense there in the world and in the relationship between human mind and sort of worldly experience. Then you might get the argument, this is when Nabuwa comes in, well, why do human beings even need prophecy? And this is a question that gets asked, particularly in a sort of theological tradition, sort of by anti-realists, by people who say, well, actually, human beings have no moral knowledge from the world. There's nothing there, but rather you need revelation in order to provide any moral knowledge. They will say, well, why do you need prophecy at all? And I guess that my answer to that from my reading would be that prophets are sent as an assistance to human beings. They're guides. They also give details of how to worship God and how and certain aspects of what God wants from human beings that maybe aren't rationally kind of appreciable. So, you know, it could be ritual matters. It could also be sort of finer details in a particular context. So, I try to sort of, and this is a very Maturidian thing, basically, to try to toe a line between saying there is moral knowledge. Human beings do have this implicit understanding. And at the same time, there's a place, a necessary place for prophecy as well. And it's a kind of, it is in a sense a balancing act, but I think if you can articulate that, it becomes a kind of very nuanced approach. And what it allows is it allows an appreciation of kind of shared human experience on a social level. So I talk about how the Quran sort of says that this ethical dimension of human life isn't just something for the Muslims, but it's something that extends to other traditions, to other people. Just on a basis of sort of their humanity. So I think that is, you know, even in our time is an important message to be able to sort of deliver. And I think it is one that's very true to the Quranic picture as well. And so I think that that's, the value of kind of looking at those terms that you mentioned.
Uh-huh. And so in addition to things like ethics, which the Quran speaks about extensively and you focus on in the book, obviously, afterlife is also something the Quran speaks about quite a bit. And you make some connections to this. So could you say, like, why is the afterlife relevant to thinking about a just society from a Quranic point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I have this idea of the what I call the moral narrative, which is basically to say that human life within the Quranic picture has this kind of broader context. A whole story, which is, you know, it starts in a kind of primordial sense before even the worldly life, and extends right through the worldly life to the afterlife or to the hereafter. And I think that it's really important to sort of contextualize Quranic ethics within this broader picture, that human beings have this destination, that there is more than just this world. And I think, you know, part of that is that it will, you know, there's going to be these consequences, you know, obviously of rewards and punishments for ethical action. And I think that when you read the Quran, the Quran is very concerned, probably a page or two doesn't go by in the Quran without some reference to these kind of eschatology and the sort of the events of the afterlife in some way or some allusion to that. And so you can't sort of divorce those aspects from the kind of worldly ethical rules or values. You have to sort of read it in that light. And I think I try to sort of bring those things in, as you say, you know, within sort of the sort of passages that I look at, I will emphasize those sections too and say, well, this is how it relates to the ethics. I mean, I remember something that I took from Professor Abdul Halim actually was this emphasis of the way that the Quran embeds its rules within stories, within discussion of the afterlife. You know, it's this total package. It's not sort of separated out as its own sort of section, but it's just sort of embedded everywhere. And there's a reason for that, because it's, you know, an encouragement. You know, the Quran is acting to kind of try to encourage. It's not just trying to say this is what good action is, so you know it, but it's trying to encourage the audience or its readers or its addressees to act in a certain way. And so these things have a powerful function, obviously, in its rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, connected to this, like the continuity of, you know, this life and the next life, I think the organization of the book is really helpful, because your different sections look at the main ideas of justice that we can understand about this world. And one of those categories is political justice. And what does that category mean in the Quran?
Yeah, I found this question of political justice a very challenging area to study in the Quran, because unlike some of the other spheres that I look at, there are much fewer sort of direct rules for political life. And when there are kind of very explicit injunctions related to political life, they tend to be very much connected to the particular life of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, and also on on that immediate first community. And so, you know, one way that I sort of tried to get around this and still excavate a kind of political justice dimension to the Quran was to look at kind of previous narratives that are in the Quran, the kind of stories of the Quran, as sort of paradigms. And I think that actually, that in a sense, that this is where you get the major material for discussing politics, is within looking at these previous narratives and how they work, and just getting this kind of level of the sort of values of the kind of tendencies of political life. I didn't sort of end up affirming from the Quran any particular political program that I think is there. I think, you know, someone may read something in or may use the Quran to develop their political thought. That's fine. But in terms of there being anything explicitly there, I didn't think so. But I did affirm a notion of khilafa or khalifa, but in a very general sense of kind of stewardship of the earth, that there, you know, and linking back to this idea of the fitra and so on, that there is a kind of requirement for human beings to sort of be able to, you know, if there's a reality of power and political life in some form of human society, then there becomes a responsibility to kind of exercise any power one has in a just way, or even in a sense, certain aspects of social order may need some sort of kind of authority, right? So at least from the Quranic perspective, there's nothing sort of inherently wrong with authority or with power, but it has to be done justly, has to be administered in a just way. And actually, one of the inspirations for the book was actually the Republic of Plato, and kind of some of that whole idea of, you know, different spheres and different aspects of how should we define justice came from my reading of the Republic and my interest in those ideas. But I would say that overall, when I come to this idea of natural law, I kind of go against the sort of Hobbesian notion of a state of nature as being sort of violent and chaotic. So I would say that that there is a sort of, if there is any state of nature, it's one of sort of harmony and peace, although that may actually never not be realized in practice. But ethically, the Quran does not present a picture where humans are kind of inherently violent chaotic and so on, but rather that there's that temptation is there, or that danger is there as a sort of a threat. So you have the initial story of Adam, and his wife, in the Islamic tradition, Hawa or Eve, they're down go down to the earth, and there's this idea that there's going to be this potential for corruption to creep in. But initially, they're honored individuals, and after repenting for their what they did, they are kind of given a sense of kind of leadership, and in the Islamic tradition, certainly considered as prophets, as Adam as a prophet at least. And then you have the biggest issue in early sort of Muslim history is who should take over the leadership of the community after the Prophet Muhammad, and this becomes a hugely contentious issue between the sort of Sunni and Shia sort of tendencies in early Islam. Again, from the Quran, I didn't see any definitive argument for that position. So although, different cases can be made, but, and of course, both Shia and Sunni groups will go back to the Quran and try to and read the Quran in a certain way. But I found the Quran leaves it open, and it's almost as if, at least from the point of view of what the Quran says, this is something that's been left up to the Muslims to organize themselves.
So as someone who's written a book about this subject, If you're trying to convince someone who might not be generally open-minded about the Quran, which of course could be a futile exercise, but just as like, for example, what would you, or not one person in particular, but just like people, what would you say, like, what is the relationship between violence and justice? And what does the Quran advocate or expect or even warn about?
The question of war or jihad even is obviously a very hot topic. I think, however, that if a reader puts these verses that do relate to warfare in perspective, and by perspective I mean other verses of the Quran and also the historical context of the time, I think they will find overall it's balanced. And what I mean is that you will have verses that encourage Muslims to battle and fight in various cases, but they're invariably framed around fighting against oppression or people who have broken treaties. So there's kind of a realism to the Quranic message. Of course, it's idealistic in calling for the best and so on, but there is a realism in things in these aspects of politics and in particularly in things like warfare. And there's also a consistent message to incline to peace. So the Quran will consistently say, but if you can find peace, then peace is best. And if you can make a treaty, then you should, and so on. So I read the Quran as not as a pacifistic scripture, but as implicitly outlining a kind of just war theory. So what I mean is that, there are different possibilities. There's a desire for there to be peace between groups. Ideally defined in kind of treaties to kind of bind it in a sort of legal framework, and even in alliances, with people with others that you can trust and so on. But there's also when if there is sort of persecution or one is attacked or these kind of things, then a military response can be appropriate in those terms in order to kind of defend or to remove the injustice. Now, I think we also should consider in this regard that warfare in the time was not like it is today. So the casualties were much smaller. We're not talking about catastrophic destruction with the modern sort of technology that we have. Also, battles would very often take place out of civilian areas. They would so I think, you know, even, you know, what the reality of what war has become, you know, in modernity is completely a different picture than obviously in the time of you know, of sort of pre-modern era, and especially actually in the Quran in this particular time, you know, we're talking about these kind of relatively sort of small scale skirmishes happening, you know, often between sort of warriors and so on, and not kind of the situation that we have, you know, in kind of in warfare and conflict today, which is, you know, completely devastating effect, you know, with hundreds of thousands and millions of people being killed. So, you know, I think obviously, you know, I think the Quran is, you know, does have this mixed picture on this, but it does embed its discussion on war and peace within this kind of broader vision of justice. And so I think that a skeptical reader should at least become familiar with that. And if they're not convinced, they're not convinced, but at least they can be aware of the kind of bigger picture on that.
Right. I mean, I think your last point is can't be overemphasized, right? If they're not convinced, they're not convinced. And some people, you know, don't want to be convinced, or, you know, looking at context, like that might be anathema to some people. But I just think it's such a hot topic, as you point out, that I'm glad to hear your thoughts about that. And so I think it's like very easy to understand. So I'm going to throw you a question that students might ask me, and we'll come back to the issue of teaching and pedagogy as we close. But it's the idea that, like, I think it's easy to imagine that to have a just society, you need communication between different political entities, and whether that results in diplomacy or war, that's, you know, those are different consequences. And then you get at this idea called distributive justice, which focuses a lot on money, financial transactions and trade and charity and interest. And so I think some students, I can see them being like, geez, you should keep religion and money separate. And, you know, that's starting to like hard to wrap my head around. But why is it so important in the Quran that this distributive justice in the form of financial fairness is such a salient point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, again, it's a major theme. I make it one of the main parts of the book, and I cover quite a few things in there. I think that the key idea in terms of money is that, again, because human beings are sort of conceived as these stewards of God on the earth, that although there is in the Quran a kind of right to private property, you know, that money is acknowledged and property is acknowledged. However, it's not an absolute right that, you know, if you have property, you can do anything you want with it. But there's kind of a delegated responsibility that exists within certain sort of values and norms. So, for example, certain transactions, you know, would not be allowed because they're considered to be unjust transactions. And so here you have the riba, which is kind of, you know, somewhat similar, like somewhat translatable by usury, or, you know, is kind of mentioned there. Secondly, there's this requirement for kind of obligatory charity or obligatory alms, which is the zakat. And this is comes from standing wealth. So it's not a kind of income tax, but it's from your standing wealth. So if you imagine, what's kind of happening there is that you can't just stay static. Your wealth can't just stay static. If it's above a certain amount, and you have to, you know, this is not necessarily, the details of this are not given in the Quran, but the principle is that if you have wealth, you cannot just kind of gather more and more and more, but rather a sort of set amount has to come out and it has to flow back into society. Now, you know, this is, you know, kind of, if you consider the sort of inequalities in the world today, we're talking about kind of these top billionaires or stuff. We're talking about huge amounts of their money would every year have to go. And obviously some of them at the moment, it's very much, you know, if you happen to be a philanthropist, then you may give a lot of your money to charity or to good causes. But if you just want to be, keep it all to yourself, then there's no kind of nothing stopping you doing that. So within the kind of Quranic picture, at least on the kind of moral level, and this is actually, you know, becomes instituted within the kind of community law as well, like in a kind of legal social level as well. You know, by the end of the period of revelation, it becomes this kind of defined legal sanction, you know, that people who have wealth must give something back. So I think that the picture here is that there is a certain responsibility to other people in society, and there's a certain positive justice that needs to be established. There's no point having this vision of the just society and this condition of justice if there's no way to establish it. So one of the means for this is for a certain amount of community wealth to go back into people in the community that need it for various reasons. And there's the breakdown of that as well. So that's the kind of overview. Obviously within every sphere, you have different injunctions, there's a whole book, there. And I've written, several chapters going through the breakdown within the Quran. So, if people are interested in these ideas, I try to explain things in a kind of clear way. And again, I think this is something to mention, is that in every area that I look at within the Quran, I'm trying to sort of unpick these kind of underlying wisdoms, what I call the hikmah, or the kind of principle or wisdom of that particular area. So I'm trying to say, I'm not just saying this is what the Quran's rules are, but why is that particular rule intended to achieve justice in that particular context? And so by doing that, I'm hoping that, it could spur thinking about, well, how could these principles be useful, in the contemporary world, and, for Muslims today to think about, and generally for readers to think about, Muslim or not, to what's the Quran really getting at in terms of these sort of the values and ethics. So that's kind of comes there and everywhere else. I try to do that.
Right. And then near the same section, you also talk about marriage. And I think, for people that think carefully about what marriage is, it's obviously a deeply social institution. But again, I'm thinking from the perspective of people that might not, study religion carefully, or, these types of things. I think marriage can often be, thought of as like, two people love each other and then they have babies or whatever. But the Quran places it in the social context where husbands and wife have certain, social and personal obligations to each other. And I think what you get at, which is helpful, is that this isn't just related to the people. This is like about how society functions. So why is marriage tied to social justice in the Quran?
Yeah, I think that what you have in the Quran, and it's potentially another controversial subject in some senses, is you have this the vision of the human, the marriage tie, which is really a kind of a building block of kind of society according to the Quranic sort of vision, because it's what ties families together, it's what sort of makes family work. Now, in terms of how it does this, it's very much responding to the particular context of Arabia, North Arabia of the time, and kind of what was going on there, what were the expectations of marriage there. And the Quran is actually trying to respond and reform those particular practices and present this a new picture, a new settlement, as it were, between husband and wife. And I think that this kind of pragmatism is one of the reasons, arguably, that the Quran was so successful in the spread of Islam and in people's adopting the religion, is because it was able to deal with the issues that were of relevance for the time. Now, I look in the book at the kind of potential life cycles of the marriage. So the kind of the so-called contract and the responsibilities and parenting and so on. And then also, well, what happens if there's marital strife and what about divorce and so on, widowing. But one of the things that I found that was most interesting is that it's in the issue of marriage that the Quran discusses the concept of what's ma'aruf, which is basically a word meaning well-known or customarily accepted, more times than anywhere else. So in the most, anywhere in the Quran, that this idea of what's kind of known amongst you already, or what you're already familiar with or customarily kind of accept, it's there in that marriage, in those marriage rules, and it's again and again emphasized. It's very, very telling when you read the Quran. And what that suggests to me, and what I mentioned this in the book, is that there's a possibility of the acceptance of a wide range of different marital arrangements based on the customs of people. So I think the Quran, yes, it gives a particular function and so on in its rules, but the whole discourse is very centered around, ultimately, this is a human level thing. This is a cultural, customary thing yes, there's a religious and a spiritual dimension if you're believing people and so on, but it's also related to how human beings live their lives. And so I think that as long as the ethics of justice are retained, there's a lot of flexibility in the Quranic discussion around marriage. And I think this also makes sense when we consider the Quran sort of call as a universal call that could be sort of lived anywhere in the world, sort of thing, that it has to have this openness to different ways of doing things. So I think that's kind of could kind of answer some of those kind of questions about, you know, why is marriage kind of mentioned in the Quran in this way or discussed in this way.
Mm-hmm. And so going off this idea that, you know, at least in the modern world, marriage is connected to the state, and that's not necessarily true for, you know, Muslims who may get married Islamically but not civilly or what have you. But one of the other ideas of justice you get at is corrective justice, to the extent that, you know, someone has to enforce things, whether it's the state or some other entity. And so what is corrective justice, and what are public crimes and private crimes, which are some categories you look at?
Corrective justice in my kind of vision or reading is a situation when the social order has been disrupted by some kind of moral or legal transgression. And so the corrective justice is, how can this be put right? So if, you know, obviously we'd like to live in a world where people don't do things that are wrong, that harm other people, but that's not the world we live in. And actually, even from the Quran's own perspective, that's kind of inevitable in that the life is a test and these possibilities are always there. Now, what I sort of say is there's a kind of process to corrective justice in the Quran. If you sort of take from, you know, all the different places where the Quran discusses this, I look at a process with several degrees. So the most important value is on the sort of in terms of relationship with God is this idea of repentance, that the person who has done wrong should repent to God in within their worldly life. And from the point of view of the victim, the victim should what they should be focusing on is forgiving the perpetrator, right? So this is a kind of ethical standard that the Quran at the highest level wants, you know, people to repent and obviously to feel sorry for what they've done to their victim, but particularly repent to God and the forgiveness from the victim. And then you have a second level or a second aspect, which is the idea of some kind of reparation or some kind of compensation being given to the victim. And finally, you have, sometimes this can be instead of a punishment, or sometimes it may go along with the punishment. It just depends on how you interpret the verses and so on. But then you also finally have a punishment, which is also it can have a social function of kind of deterrence, or it can also have a kind of this is the main one, or it also could the threat of the punishment, obviously, or the sort of the reality of the punishment could be a means for this repentance if the repentance wasn't made already, then maybe it would be made then. So this is the kind of picture overall. Now, how this breaks down, and it's obviously too kind of there's a lot to it, you know, in the two chapters that I write on this. But I break this down into public and private crimes, and this is kind of instead of a kind of more famous classical breakdown amongst Muslim jurists, which is between the so-called qisas and hudud. So what you will get in the classical theory is that you either have the qisas, which are kind of meant to be these crimes against other people, and then the hudud are these crimes that are kind of against God. And so they look at that in this way. And I felt that didn't quite kind of hang together as a theory, even though it's very well established. And so what I try to do instead is to argue for a different breakdown, which is basically a public crime, which for me is the, you know, basically in the Quran, murder and sort of brigandage, which is kind of, you know, social kind of could be robbery. It's kind of like chaos, you know, and you know, kind of something that, you know, was quite common in the pre-modern era, when there's less of a kind of law and order, or it might be even common in places that are, you know, outside the kind of have a weaker kind of government and police system. But these are public crimes because they happen in the public square. And if you're a victim, you know, when someone murders someone, there's no way that the authorities can't become aware of it. There has to be funerals, there has to be, inheritance, there has to be all these things that come from that. And likewise, in brigandage, it's directly against the authority of the government, in a sense, right? It's kind of like a internal war within a state or in a community. And so because the governments have to be, because the governing authorities have to be informed, then the forgiveness aspect of that part of, from the point of view of justice, has to be done at the state level or at the governing level. That if there is going to be a sort of a forgiveness, it has to be done in the public sphere and with the representatives, you know, to some extent of the governance. But when something is a private crime, what we're talking about here is things that happen not necessarily in public. So in the Quran, I mentioned thievery, so stealing things, fornication. If someone's married, adultery, that would be, and slander, right? Which is in the Quran, particularly relates to slandering someone based on accusing them of fornication when they haven't been doing it. And what I say is that because these are private crimes, what the Quran is basically saying is that the forgiveness for that can happen at the private level. And this also draws on some of the context of the time of the Quran's revelation and some of the hadith reports and so on. So I try to bring some of that in to give a context for what's going on. And what that means is that there doesn't necessarily, if forgiveness happens at the private level, it never goes to the authorities and no punishment is given. And so this can be an important thing when obviously, some of the kind of the Quranic punishments, they're well known, and people may take in, especially in our modern times, would maybe take issue with those punishments, right? Or find them in some sense inappropriate or something. So be that as it may, what I'm saying is that the Quran itself isn't saying that these definitely have to be imposed, but rather that within the private sphere, these things can be ironed out amongst people without those things having to happen. And those are only a kind of last resort at the sort of level of when the governance authority gets involved. So that's kind of roughly what I argue in that last part of the book.
Well, that's really helpful. And I'd like to connect something else that you write later in the book with this idea, and then we can start wrapping up. And so on page 194, Dr. Harvey, you write, "What is the exegetical tradition except a succession of scholars reinterpreting the meanings of scripture in light of their own horizons?" And I'll qualify that by, like, obviously you're not saying, people are just like willy-nilly and like whatever. And, you're obviously like very careful in citing your sources and explaining things. So I see this as like a big picture reflection that's asking a really serious question. But if we go back to this idea of, use the example of warfare, like warfare 1400 years ago is very different than today. And so how do you make sense of like what's considered a crime and what are appropriate punishments for crimes, and how is the reader of the Quran supposed to understand how to apply these ideas to whatever context they're in?
These are massive questions. I would say, in terms of the quote you read out, the tafsir tradition and just broadly, Muslim intellectual tradition has always developed and changed. And this is something that is, in history, and it continues to today. And what I mean is that there's always a room for new opinions to emerge and to become adopted. And at the same time, there's great respect, of course, for previous viewpoints. So there's a kind of continuous process of like filtering, generating new ideas. Do they get accepted? What arguments can there be for them? How do our own, perspective on the material in the Quran and in the tradition change over time? So, the quote you mentioned, I'm drawing on some on Gadamer's idea of the horizon. So we all, as I said, we all have a certain vantage point that we're on, or that we're within, and we are always trying to make sense given that. We're not able to, sort of find an absolute meaning, but we can actually, from the point of view, from a Muslim's point of view, the Quran as a divine communication has the potential for infinite meaning. So really it's about trying to give the best meanings we can in our time, in a rigorous way that's defensible and that sort of joins up. So when you come to these major level, ethical discussions or you know, jurisprudential debates. You know, I don't have any sort of simple answers. What I would say is that if my contention would be, if we are able to have some implicit natural ability to see what's right and wrong, as I've argued with the idea of fitra, and we also have the guidance of the principles of scripture, and from the tradition, and also, and I've tried to articulate some of the Quranic principles in my book, then it may be possible to engage a hermeneutic that looks at some of the classic rules and says, well, do these match the realities of our time? And does there need to be an adjustment in order to meet those deeper purposes? So I think if you have a nuanced approach, like a theological approach and an ethical approach, and you're able to sort of join up and the idea of rules to a sort of deeper wisdom, and I think that this can be done in a way that's superficial, and it can be done in a way that's just changing the law to whatever seems conducive to current thinking or whatever's popular in our particular society. I think that's to be avoided. But if someone is to be serious in their ethics, in their ethical reflection and deliberation, in their knowledge of the text and in the times and the context of societies, then I think there's a place for new interpretations to emerge in that kind of very rich way. And this needs it needs to be a whole movement. It can't just be one or two people having a few ideas. It should be something that's, engaging whole, subfields of study, and I think this is beginning to happen, or it has been happening for a while in various ways. And, there needs to be a continued engagement with those ideas. And, you will see changes and renewal and reform happening in various ways. So I think it's an ongoing reality. And my perspective would just be to try to, do things in a way that's joined up with the kind of broader theology and hermeneutics and so on, not just in a very kind of legal focused way without that wider or larger picture.
And so on this note of, thinking about big challenging questions and how to go about answering these types of things, which again, I think the book does really well, especially because it's so well organized, but also, very heavily documented with your sources and what have you. Have you had a chance to use this text in your teaching contexts?
I mean, I teach a kind of a course on contemporary Quranic studies at Ibrahim College. And one of the things that I do on that course is look at kind of, contemporary interpretation of the Quran, and also sort of what we could call the ethical turn. Recent decades, a turn to looking at Quranic ethics. And there's a number of interesting figures. You have an interesting feminist discourse, which I go into as part of that. People like, Keshia Ali has written really interesting work on sort of the Quran and ethics and so on. And I hope that my book can sort of have a place in that discussion as well, as an example of kind of ethical interpretation of the Quran. And so, yeah, I sort of take the liberty of doing like a 1 week where we look at something from my book and discuss it and so on. And obviously it's the easiest seminar to prepare. So that's good as well.
Uh-huh. Have you had a chance to talk with non-academics or non-students who have read the book to get their impressions? Like, especially since it talks about a lot of hot button topics, just from like a global perspective of people that might be interested in these things.
Obviously the book is still fairly fresh from the press. So I haven't I haven't had the chance to sort of meet so many people that have read it. I hope to carry on doing that. But I mean, when I have had conversations with people who maybe are not completely in Quranic studies field, I have had some positive feedback that they've enjoyed the sort of the level I pitch it. So it's kind of, it is, I think, accessible to the general interested reader. While at the same time, it's hopefully, especially in the notes and so on, and the overall framing, it's got the depth to interest the kind of scholarly people and the kind of graduate students and people who are in the field. So obviously writing any book is a kind of balancing act in that way. But I really tried, with the book to include a glossary, to include, useful notes, to define things in a clear way, to try to write it in a level that's not assuming that someone is an expert in Islamic studies. And I think that hopefully, particularly when the book comes out in paperback, which should be quite soon, that more readers will be able to get access to it and be able to engage with the ideas. And, I hope they enjoy it.
Yeah, I definitely appreciated the clarity of prose just as the consumer perspective. But I think the ideas are also presented clearly, which is, I think, many people will appreciate. So, Dr. Harvey, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Before we conclude, could you tell us a little bit about current projects that you're working on that may or may not be related to the book?
At the moment, I'm working on a second book, which is a work of constructive theology. It's also going to be published by Edinburgh University Press. And this book, what I'm doing is I'm taking the Maturidi tradition. I told you that Maturidi's Kitab al-Tawhid is such an important text to me. I'm taking this text and trying to reread it in the light of contemporary philosophy and philosophical theology. And this is taken in the analytic tradition, also the continental tradition, both of which I'm interested in. And I'm looking at things like reason and tradition, epistemology, ontology, the nature of God, and so on in that book. Because I'm, in order to do that, I'm basically being forced to translate the Kitab al-Tawhid, which is also a very, very challenging thing. But I'm working on that, and I've actually linked up with a colleague who's out in Istanbul called Kayhan, and we've kind of decided together to try to work on the translation of the Kitab al-Tawhid. So that's a kind of a long-term project that one day we're hoping to release it, maybe in two tranches, like in volume one, do half of it, and then a volume two. And also I'm co-editing a book for the International Institute of Islamic Thought with Dr. Daniel Tutt, who is an American philosopher. And this is on modern theologies and ethics of justice. And this is drawing together a number of articles by kind of generally younger scholars who are looking at justice in Islam in different ways and exploring different kind of horizons and possibilities there. So that's an exciting project. Going forward, I've actually got quite ambitious plans for a whole series of books, which kind of each explore different areas of Muslim thought and kind of build on each other. So the kind of theology book is, in a way, it's going back to what I've got a whole chapter on theology in the Quran and the Just Society, but I can't do everything in that short chapter. So I'm trying to building out of that and trying to develop that. And then likewise, I want to do the same for sort of ethics and hermeneutics and so on and so forth. So I'm hopefully will be busy for some time on these various areas.
Yeah, I should say so. It sounds like it. But I think it sounds like really exciting stuff as well. And it's Dr. Harvey, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you about the book. And thank you so much for joining us. And I'll look forward to keeping apprised of your future projects.
And the same for you. It's been great speaking. And I hope that people are able to access the book. And I'm very happy to correspond with issues and questions raised from the book if anyone wants to get in touch.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
That was my conversation with Dr. Ramon Harvey, Aziz Foundation Lecturer in Islamic Studies at Ibrahim College in London, and the author of The Quran and the Just Society, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2018. Thanks for listening.